Let's quickly move on to our top story. In about 30 minutes from now, the Prime Minister lands in Paris. He is in Paris ahead of a visit to the United States. While in France, he'll be attending the AI Summit. It's a crucial summit where India is going to be co-chairing a very, very crucial meeting. What's it all about? And what about the state of the strategic relationship between India and France? That's also very crucial. I'll be explaining all of that. But I'm joined by a very special guest, Rajiv Chandrasekhar. Somebody who follows AI and tech perhaps more than any other minister in the government or anywhere in the region. Thanks very much for being with us. Mr. Chandrasekhar, first, why is it important for the Prime Minister to be part of this AI summit? There are AI summits and there are AI summits. How is this any different?
So, Vishnu, the first AI summit started in 2023 in November. The UK government hosted that. I represented the government of India then. I was in the government then. And that focused on safety. And you fast forward now to about 18 months later, this summit is appropriately called AI Action Summit. And in that, there's deep meaning because for all these months that we have talked about AI, we've talked about it as this great technology that has this great transformative power. And India is the one country in the world which is almost a case study for observers of deploying tech in real terms to transform governance, to transform and expand the economy and transform people's lives. India being a co-chair of an AI Action Summit is, in my opinion, extremely appropriate and extremely relevant to how AI will be deployed in the coming months and years. So I think this is an extremely important summit. The fact that India is co-chairing it and Prime Minister Narendra Modi ji is today seen around the world as an absolute practitioner of technology in terms of how it's deployed in government and governance. So I think this is an extremely important and a very appropriate summit for India to be a co-chair of.
Mr. Chandrasekhar, we are in a phase when you've got different AI apps. So you've got Grok, which I use, you've got DeepSeek from China, you've got ChatGPT, and you don't have an Indian model at the moment. Now, we also have an AI mission, and we put in thousands of crores into that. How is a part of that AI mission meant to develop an Indian AI app or technology which represents our interests?
Look, I think, Vishnu, it's important to understand that the conversations in the AI Action Summit are precisely about this. There are these large general purpose, large language models that are being built in the US, primarily in the US, and now in China as well. And there are all of these conversations about safety and trust and the risks of AI. So there are these conversations that are happening. And I think this is extremely important because India's view and our Prime Minister's view, which he stated way back in December 2023, is that we want to create these foundational models, not general purpose, but India wants to deploy AI and create AI foundational models that will solve real problems in agriculture, in healthcare, in education, in terms of language translation. So therefore, India's approach is not the Western American approach of building these large, expensive, general purpose, large language models that will, lead to AGI and ASI and all of that. But it is to do what we have done with DPI, using technology to solve the problems that our people face, our economy and governance faces, and to create these smaller, much more narrower focused, specific purpose focused model. So we are already, our mission is focused on that. And I have no doubt the minister spoke about that recently, the government has spoken about that recently, that we will have very quickly, very soon rather, these very application focused AI models that will be transforming governance and transforming people's lives in real terms.
So for example, in the case of healthcare, I can see the applicability of AI where a machine reads, let us say, a radiology report or a certain CAT scan and offers a doctor advice or suggestions, a second set of eyes in a sense, not the primary one. That's one area where obviously the speed of getting diagnosis is improved. I can see that as being something that we adopt. What about agriculture? How can AI help Indian agriculture?
Look, Vishnu, what you talked about in terms of healthcare is very, that's a very tip of the iceberg kind of a thing. That's not, that doesn't need a model that is really more of an application. But, you know, India is such a diverse country with people that live very different, with very different physiological makeup, very different resistances, very different diet and food. And therefore, the ability of a healthcare model, a model that will be able to diagnose, predict what is going to happen to a certain community of people, what they should be looking out for. So this is not simply about interpreting X-rays or MRIs. This is about using the power of AI to transform our healthcare planning, transform our healthcare delivery system, and to be able to anticipate and forecast what type of healthcare help people require. And the other flip side of healthcare is medicine discovery. And we will be in a position to create cures for diseases that we have not been able to crack for many, many years and decades, including but not limited to cancer. So this is very powerful, transformative stuff that we are talking about. And so our Prime Minister is right on point and on the money when he talks about us focusing on specific areas with these models that are going to create solutions that will have a direct impact on people's lives, which they have not had so far.
You know, that's fascinating what you're saying. Could you give some more examples on how focused AI applications can change our lives in India?
No, look, for example, agriculture. Today we have the DPI in India, and a lot of what the farmers today face, we are able to understand and analyze based on government data. But imagine when you layer the DPI for agriculture with AI, and we are able to predict cropping patterns, we are able to predict natural calamity and water and monsoon patterns way in advance. And that becomes an input into a farmer's economic and business planning, his own cropping and crop planning, and his own life. He can think of his life, and he can think of his agricultural investments over a medium term rather than having to live from year to year. So these are very, very deep transformational things that are going to happen with the power of AI, Vishnu. And sorry if I sound very excited, but I am a...
I think we are all excited by this. We are all trying to figure out where it's going, but Paris, go ahead, yeah.
Yeah, and and these conversations in Paris are absolutely brilliant, because I'm listening to people today talk about what is in the realm of possible in the coming 1 or 2 years that 5 years ago or 3 years ago we would have never thought was even remotely possible, whether it's in healthcare, whether it's in agriculture, whether it's in natural calamity and sustainability planning. So all of these areas that we were in a sense limited by how we could see beyond the horizon, we are now with AI, and sorry to use an Aero India cliche, but we are going to use AI to be able to see beyond the horizon and predict things beyond the horizon for many of these very, very focused application areas.
And it's going to be free, right? When we develop it as a country, we aren't charging money for it, for our farmers.
And so that's an interesting question, Vishnu, because that is one of the core debates that is undergoing, that's taking place in the AI Action Summit, which is open source versus these closed black boxes. So you have ChatGPT and the American systems that are absolutely black boxes, versus what DeepSeek has done today, appended that model and said we are going to open source AI. Now there's a whole debate going on that we should not have other people have access to AI. There could be the bad guys who get access to AI if it's open source, and therefore it should be closed and guarded and proprietary. But as somebody who's been in technology for 30, 35 years, I said this in a panel yesterday, that anybody who tries to defend a closed source model is going to find that some youngster somewhere in China or in India is going to create a model that is far superior and far better. So I don't think there is much of an argument for a closed source model. The future is open source, as we have shown in India with the DPI. I think AI will also go down that same road, where transparency, lack of bias, accountability are all going to be, in a sense, possible because of the open sourcing and scrutiny of the models.
The other part of this, of course, is hardware. Semiconductors, chips, computing power needs to be absolutely massive, even if we have, even if we aren't developing large language models. And we've got a semiconductor policy as well that would potentially feed into all of this in the future. But just in terms of the inherent computing power with supercomputers and chips that we have existing in India, are we well placed to do what you're talking about?
So Vishnu, that is the third leg of the conversations that are sort of being had in the AI Action Summit that I'm picking up, which is, the conventional wisdom about 6 months ago was that unless you had these huge multi-billion dollar data centers and hyperscalers, you would not be in a position to train and build good models. Now, DeepSeek has again upended that. And there is clearly evidence to show that scaling and compute infrastructure investments are going to decline on one hand, and that the amount of compute capacity that you require with more and more efficient algorithms will be less than what was expected. So I think that is the other assumption that is being, in a sense, upended and being scrutinized. But that is that, do you require these multi $25-30 billion to create a really world-scale, world-standard large language model? And the answer, it seems to be today, which it was not 5 months ago, that it is not necessarily true that that is going to be a need. But of course, there is a shortage today. NVIDIA dominates the AI compute space. But from what I hear, AMD is about 6 to 10 months behind, and they are going fast catching up. And there are other hardware and semiconductor vendors who are going to catch up to this new game in town. And from somebody who's seen this cycle many times over, Vishnu, I will say that infrastructure will not be the entry barrier to AI.
Right.
It was in the past with mini computers and the PC upended it. You saw that many times in the tech cycle play itself out. I suspect that, and at least this is a widely held view now, gaining more and more currency after DeepSeek, that what you thought was the big entry barrier of AI infrastructure is not necessarily going to be that much of a barrier going into the future.
All right. Rajiv Razashekar, wonderful speaking to you. Let's see what happens over the next couple of days. Absolutely fascinating. We are at the cusp of new technology. Where it takes us is something that we need to look at closely. Well, I'm going to move on now to a little bit more on the visit of the Prime Minister to Paris. He lands in a little while from now, approximately 15 to 20 minutes. Why is this important? Well, with the Prime Minister in France on an important visit, the focus also shifts not just to AI, which we were talking about, but to the close strategic partnership between New Delhi and Paris, and that includes key defence deals. Now, India and France are looking to conclude a deal for 26 Rafale M fighters for the Indian Navy. These fighters are to be embarked on the indigenous aircraft carrier Vikrant. That's a deal which could be in the range of 60,000 crore rupees. Now, don't expect this to be announced, but the fact that there's already mention of that strategic conversation which will take place means that this is certainly something which will be discussed. It's already in a very advanced stage of negotiation. It's not a question of if, but when this is announced. India is also looking to make in our country three more French-designed Scorpion-class submarines that you see over here. Six are already in service with the Indian Navy, the last one quite recently commissioned into the Indian Navy. The three that we are going to be building at Mazagon Docks in Mumbai will be modified versions of this particular submarine, the Scorpion class. This will cost us, for three submarines, a whopping 36,000 crores. That's the estimate. That's what reports suggest. Now, all of this comes at a time when Aero India, the largest defense expo, began in Bengaluru today. It's Asia's largest and comes at a time when the Indian Air Force remains distinctly undergunned as the Chinese and Pakistani air forces expand. So what am I talking about? Well, what you'll now see is the Chinese J-20 stealth fighter aircraft, right? That's what you have up on the screen over there. China has already built 250 of them. India has no fighters in this class. What is a stealth fighter? In very simple language, the design of the aircraft and the way it suppresses radar emissions or doesn't give out radar emissions means that it is virtually impossible in most cases to radar. Radar is the primary sensor which is used to detect aircraft in the air. If you are largely invisible to radar or you present a radar signature which is that of a golf ball or maybe a small bird, then it becomes difficult for ground-based sensors and other aircraft in the air to actually track you. So that's what stealth aircraft are all about. China's got 250 of these. We don't have a single one. Now, India's own stealth fighter is called the AMCA. That's what it looks like. This is a model. It's not the real thing. This has not even been prototyped. This is just a model, right? It'll begin entering service post-tests 11 years from now. So China's got 250 of their stealth fighters already in service. We are looking to get our first Made in India one in service 11 years from now. Now, at Aero India, Russia has flown its most advanced stealth fighter, the Sukhoi 57 that you see over here. This is on offer to the Indian Air Force, should we want it. But remember, this was a joint project which India and Russia had embarked on. India got out of the project because the aircraft a few years back didn't appear to be meeting our requirements. But circumstances have changed. We aren't really getting stealth fighters from elsewhere in the world. Would we consider this once again? Now, in a clear indicator of how India is also friendly with the West, the US has come in with its own frontline stealth fighter, the F-35 that you see over here. Now, the F-35 is not on offer presently to the Indian Armed Forces because of key Russian weaponry that we continue to operate. America basically saying, if you want this aircraft, then you can no longer operate systems like the Russian-built S-400 surface-to-air missile system. That becomes unviable for us because we've spent $5.4 billion to acquire those systems. Russia is worried that the signature, the radar signature of these aircraft could be gleaned by Russian radars and transmitted over there. So they've got lots of problems with that. But it's interesting that India has both the Russian and the American stealth fighter in the same airspace and literally parked next to each other in Bangalore. In the meanwhile, India is banking closely on another aircraft, the Made in India Tejas that you see on your screen over here. There are hundreds of Tejas fighters on order, although there are now delays in deliveries of its American engines. Delay in delivery of engines means that there are delays by the time these enter service with the Indian Air Force. But there is now talk of somewhat faster delivery of engines from the engine manufacturer, which is an American company, General Electric. So perhaps the pace of these jets entering will improve. Now, the jet itself is fine. Does it compare with stealth platforms? No, not really. It's an older generation aircraft, which is why there's a larger deal in play for 114 more fighter aircraft that the Indian Air Force says is absolutely imperative. Now, that deal could be worth upwards of $20 billion if indeed it is closed. What you are seeing is the Rafale fighter. That's one of the jets which the Indian Air Force is considering in this tender. It may not win that particular contract. Another aircraft might. But the size of that deal, absolutely whopping. What's going to take place? We're going to have to wait and find out. I'm joined now by a real expert in this, Angad Singh. He tracks civil aviation and military aviation perhaps closer than anybody in the country. He is at Aero India and joins us now. Angad, thank you very much for being with us. First up, the stealth wars, in a sense, at Aero India. You've got the Russian Sukhoi, you've got the American F-35, and you've got India as a prospective client, at least for the Russian aircraft presently. Why is the acquisition of a stealth platform important for India?
You've already gone over that, Vishnu. It's pretty clear that the best counter to stealth capability is to field stealth capability of your own. Everything else is a hack at best. You can take specific kinds of ground radar or optical and infrared sensing systems to try and negate some of the advantages that stealth brings to the battle. But stealth is the real game changer in terms of both strike and anti-air operations. And the only way to counter it is to get right up there with it within your own stealth aircraft.
The other important deal which India is looking at is for more fighter aircraft, 114 jets. Now, this is something that has been going on for, what, at least a decade or so since there has been conversation of 114 aircraft. None of these are stealth fighters. So the question, therefore, is if you're looking to consider a platform which is a non-stealth fighter, how does that really help the Indian Air Force at a time when the Chinese And in the future, the Pakistanis, near future, will be deploying stealth fighters. The Chinese already have.
That, unfortunately, Vishnu, that's just a symptom of a fundamentally dysfunctional and shambolic procurement system. Because we're talking about 114 fighters today in 2025. This is a deal that should have been closed and completed production by now. This was supposed to have happened in the early 2000s, you know, 20 years ago. So obviously the requirement hasn't kept pace with the reality because it's 20 years out of date. 114 fighters is a shot in the arm for the Indian Air Force, which is now operating about a dozen squadrons fewer than it should be anyway. But I mean, you know, against 250 stealth aircraft, this is at best a holding action. This is not evening the scales or tipping them in our favor at all.
And the aircraft that we briefly, in fact, we're seeing on our screen is the Tejas. It's a fourth generation aircraft. It's a great aircraft as a fourth generation aircraft, particularly in the Mark II variant when that does come. But again, acquiring this in decent numbers will mean at least a decade by the time the Mark II variant, which is the real variant we want, is fully operational in the Indian Air Force, which again begs the question, great aircraft, wonderful technology, but we've been outpaced by newer technology coming in by the time the ultimate variant of this jet enters service, right?
Exactly. That's exactly it.
And we are both extremely unpopular for saying this, right?
I'm not even going to get into the popularity problem. But it's actually a phenomenal little machine in its class. It punches well above its weight. There was a multinational air exercise last year, a few months ago, where I think I spoke to just about every foreign contingent that flew against the Tejas, and they were all unanimous in their sort of surprise at how much of a challenge this aircraft was in the close-in dogfight. You know, you hear things like underpowered and draggy and slow. But it's a small aircraft with a small visual signature. It's hard to shake off once it gets on your tail. And that was great to hear. But the world's moved on from dogfighting. You know, I think it was premature to have said that 50 years ago in Vietnam, but it's very true today, which makes this small, short-range aircraft, which doesn't have the longest legs, the longest-ranged air-to-air weaponry, a bit of, shall we say, slightly out of date in today's air combat scenario.
In the interim period,
said,
yep, go ahead. No, in the interim period,
said,
we
think...
are, Angad, getting into 26 Rafale aircraft for the Indian Navy. Finish your thought and then tell me about why the Rafale M for the Indian Navy is important.
Sure, thanks. That said, the LCA Mark 1A is good enough as a sort of bread and butter fighter for the Indian Air Force. I think 100, 150 of these aircraft make a lot of sense. I do disagree with you somewhat that the definitive Mark 2 is a good idea at this stage, for exactly the same reason that we're discussing right now. When Mark 2 comes, it will still be very firmly a fourth generation aircraft in what will be very firmly a fifth generation world. So I think. And I used to say the opposite of this maybe 10 years ago. But today, I think the time for Mark II is past. We do seem to have put some eggs in that basket with the F414 license production, technology transfer, and so on. But I do feel that given the juncture that Indian Air Power is at this moment, that entire perspective plan of what the Indian Air Force should look like does deserve a bit of a relook.
The jet on our screen is the Rafale M. We're buying that pretty much. I mean, unless there's any last second hiccup. Why is that important for the Navy?
The Rafale, I think, is it's an acknowledgement that the MiG-29A has not worked out the way we had hoped. And with 45 MiG-29s less, however many have been lost in accidents, that's not really a nucleus around which you can build a two-carrier navy. Even if we had all 45, you would need a certain number in maintenance, in reserve for attrition, and then you'd need at least a minimum of two squadrons, one for shore-based training and one for operations off the carrier. So I think the Navy was always going to have to augment its MiG-29K procurement with some other fighter, and it seems they've settled on the Rafale, and it's the most credible modern carrier fighter out there, short of a fifth generation.
And a final question to you, not about aircraft, but about submarines. We are going to be manufacturing 3 more Scorpion-class submarines in India. That's, again, a deal which is likely done. In fact, let's have the images of the submarine, if we can. This is the latest one, which has been commissioned into the Indian Navy. I think that's the Vakshir. The new ones would be somewhat more advanced, somewhat larger. But I think one of the key aspects of this is that the skills that we've built up in India to actually manufacture these at home, they remain. And that's been a problem in the past. So when you build a line to build submarines and there are no orders, then building submarines is a perishable skill. Therefore, could you tell our viewers why it's important to keep going and also to build an ecosystem of manufacture?
Again, Vishnu, you've more or less covered the answer. It is a perishable skill, and it's a skill we lost regrettably in the 90s when we gave up on building the Type 209. There's a lot of commentary, and I think rightly so, fairly so, that this new order for Scorpions at $1 billion-ish a submarine is expensive, and it absolutely is. But I think that's a fair price to pay to keep those skills alive, to keep building that ecosystem, to keep that industrial nucleus active. Because tomorrow, this same set of skills, the same industrial capability will be leveraged across a multitude of subsurface projects. I think these are the kind of decisions I'd like to see more of, where you pay upfront to retain capability and capacity in country.
All right, Angad, wonderful speaking to you. Have a great Aero India. Thank you very much for being with us. We're going to take a short break at this stage. Coming up after that, we're going to revisit our conversation on the significance of the Prime Minister's visit to Paris for the AI summit and the important strategic relationship with somebody who knows about the relationship better than anybody else. Javed Ashraf was our ambassador to Paris till just 2 months back. And I talked to him about the importance of that relationship. That's coming up after the break. And I should add, the Prime Minister should be landing in Paris anytime now. Stay tuned. Welcome back. The Prime Minister expected to land in Paris anytime now for a critical AI summit, artificial intelligence, but also a visit where he'll be reviewing the strategic relationship between India and France. I'm now joined by Javed Ashraf, the former Indian ambassador to Paris, till just 2 months back, somebody who knows that relationship between the two countries inside out. Thanks very much, sir, for being with us. How important is it for the Prime Minister and India to be a part of international negotiations in Paris, which effectively shape the face of AI and international regulation over it?
Well, I think it's an extremely important event, and I think we need to recognize that Prime Minister Shri Narendra Modi has been invited to co-chair this AI Action Summit with President Emmanuel Macron. And it is important because, you know, we, over a 75-year period, we have reached that pivotal moment in the evolution of AI, which is now permeating every aspect of our lives. It is going to affect everything from governance to polity to economics. It is going to shape competitiveness, power, prosperity, and you know, in a sense, international relations also. So it's going to affect citizens, societies, nations, the future of work or economy, national security and defense, and of course, as I mentioned, the very complexion of the international order. And therefore, at this point of time, you see there are multiple and sometimes competing initiatives to shape the future character of AI governance, of standards, norms, regulations, because AI, unlike some of the previous technological milestones in human history, is taking place simultaneously across the world. and its reach across the borders is seamless. It affects all of us, whether it originates in Silicon Valley or somewhere in Japan. Now, and therefore, the need and the urgency to get everyone around the table to speak about, AI safety, AI governance, the rights of citizens, the way it's going to affect all of us is important. But also, I think there is another aspect which is going to be particularly important for India, but also for this particular summit, is because AI by its very nature is resource intensive. It requires high level of compute power, data quality, data sets, skills, financial resources. There is a great risk that in this race for AI, we may end up with concentration of power in the hands of few companies, few countries, and the others get bypassed. And therefore, you can have a more fragmented, more divided world. You can lead to a situation where, once again, you see, as we have seen in the past, power concentrated in the hands of few countries and the others left behind, particularly Global South. So that's one aspect of it. But the second is that we have to find ways to address their needs, build their trust, make this AI age an inclusive one. And this is where particularly India and France can play a role, because we are both governed by a great sense of strategic autonomy. We have very convergent views and philosophies on the shape of internet and how it's going to affect our society. And also use this opportunity to redirect our focus away from this great race on the power of AI systems to one in which we can develop use cases and models to solve some of the more intractable problems of the world and make a more equitable, more inclusive, more sustainable future for this world. There are a whole lot of problems that we can solve with the help of AI. But then it requires a lot of collective effort, as we have done sometimes in the past. So both in terms of regulation and in opportunities.
Well, some big news coming in now. The Prime Minister has landed in Paris, and we should be getting images of that. Ambassador Ashraf, jet engines, an important area. India needs jet engine collaboration. We want to try and build our own jet engines. For that, we need collaboration. The DRDO and Safran of France are looking to develop a fighter jet engine. But India is also looking at the United States and General Electric. It's a lot of money in all of this. Where does the French project stand?
See, this discussion has been going on for a long time. People can have different points of view. I have to convinced that had we in 2016, for example, taken up the Safran offer for a complete design, development, industrialization, production, qualification and certification, including teaching us on the software tools and advanced materials, which are particularly important for hot sections of the engine, we would have had an engine to power LCA today. I mean, I say this with a great sense of conviction. Some of those who were associated with it will bear me out. But for some reason, perhaps we felt that we were already invested in the design of LCA around G4404, and then subsequently 414. But and even today, what Safran is offering for future military jet engines includes 100% TOT in design development, again, as I said, all the way to certification, with guarantees that they would on performance. What it does is that it gives you complete sovereign control of technology, the capacity to design engines yourself, the knowledge of metallurgy, as well as of the complex processes of the hot section, which is the most difficult thing. And you can then do anything with it, like we have done when Safran and ISRO worked together for the Vikas engine in the 1970s, which was really not just a manufacturing TOT. A manufacturing TOT will only give you the capacity to put together things, but does not tell you how or why that those things happen. And it creates a perpetual technology crutch. And therefore, right, when we start looking at technology, we have to use this litmus test, not just simply the easy way out of manufacturing TOT. After all, we have manufactured TOT for Sukhoi engines and the Jaguar engines for the Rolls-Royce, but that didn't teach us much. So therefore, you need to get to a situation which Safran has offered, which is that you get into the basic design, development, metallurgy, advanced materials, the hot section part of it, and all the way to certification, and that with complete sovereignty and ownership of the technology, the IP will be ours. And I think that's a great proposal, which will give us long-term. And DRDO and Safran are talking about it. I'm sure now I'm out of the government. I'm sure they continue to look at it seriously. It's a long-term project, but one, yes, I think, critical for our future.
One of the deals that's essentially done, not signed as yet, is for 26 Rafales for the Indian Navy and 3 Scorpene submarines for also the Indian Navy. We've already built 6 of these French-designed submarines in Mazagon docks. How important are these? And then there's the larger, of course, issue of 114 fighters for the Indian Air Force that India is also looking at. But again, the French connection important. Tell us why.
Well, I think, you know, for if I can be candid, and in part of that is our own, you know, the rigor, if I could say, in a positive way, of our decision-making process. There are multiple issues, multiple stakeholders involved in this. But, you know, it's an ongoing process. The process of negotiations for Rafale M is taking place. I'm sure it is going through its, you know, prescribed procedure. We have our own specific requirements, and so therefore Dassault and in the Indian Navy would have negotiated some of those things now, and we're at a stage where perhaps as we can be going for our political level approvals, the official level approvals, and then they would sign the contract. But the important thing I'd like to point out to you, Vishnu, here is that we've known that we're going to have an aircraft carrier by a certain date, but we didn't act enough fast enough on our own to look at aircraft. So you actually have an aircraft carrier without aircraft. And this is not a this is not an issue that is at the political level. It's for Navy to introspect and for Ministry of Defense to introspect on why we reached the situation where you have an aircraft carrier but doesn't have aircraft to fly. But this is going to happen soon, I'm sure. And it is a great aircraft. With regard to the Scorpions, again, that's an ongoing process. This time the order will be a repeat order on MDL. It's not going to be on the Naval Group. Naval Group will be a partner for MDL. And very interestingly, this time there is a clear prescription that there must be 65% indigenous content. And that's a huge thing because, you know, a submarine involves hundreds of thousands of small parts, etc. Yeah. When we reach that 65% indigenous content, we're also going to be in a position where we can, you know, our naval industrialization process, our defense industrialization process will go forward. But more important, we will be in a position down the line to actually make submarines for other countries, because there are very few countries that can actually make conventional submarines in this part of the world. And this is where you will see the maximum demand for naval assets arising. Sure. So it's an important project in the evolution of India's capacity to deliver advanced naval systems, including submarines.
Both sides, Ambassador, have agreed to work on establishing a partnership on low and medium power modular reactors, also small modular reactors, advanced modular reactors. We've cooperated on the Jaitapur nuclear power plant. How is that also a key part of the strategic relationship?
I think the future of nuclear energy lies in both. I mean, there are advantages and disadvantages of both. Large nuclear reactors are certainly going to be more efficient. In the long run, they will deliver power at a much lower cost. The initial just time and the cost required, capital cost required to set it up is quite high. The source of, you know, the power from where it arises is a huge one. And the small modular reactors are going to be more dispersed. I think we have to look at, continue to look at both. There is a still, you know, small modular reactors are yet to mature. I would say that, for example, France is continuing to do both. As you know, 70% of their power generation capacity today is from nuclear. Yeah. And they are, after, you know, a few decades, they are again going to start the process. And they are going to build 6 new reactors and their options for 8 more. So they have plans to build 14 of those EPR 1600 megawatt reactors while they are continuing to pursue the SMRs as well. Because I think both will serve different sets of needs. And in India's case, given the enormous requirement of baseload clean energy, particularly. And I'd like to point to you one very important point, that in the growth of energy demand, demand for electricity globally is growing at twice the pace for any other energy sources. And it's because of, and in the case of developing countries or global south, the rate of growth is six times higher. Mobility, data centers, electrification of villages, better consumption standards. You're going to need, can't simply rely on renewable energy. So a combination of SMRs and large reactors are going to be the way forward. Important point here is that SMRs are yet to mature, but I think in the next 5 to 10 years, you're definitely going to see SMRs become. But you need to change your regulatory environment. Sure. You need to change your liability law. And we certainly need to look at the basic who can invest in nuclear power, because there is two different sides to it. One part is the nuclear fuel cycle, yep, and the other is the power generation. Yes. Can we find a regulatory framework where we allow private investment or foreign investment to come into power generation while DAE and the regulatory bodies, sure, have a clear safeguards and oversight and ownership of the nuclear fuel cycle? I think that's eminently possible. I think with the new announcements that we have seen in the budget, both with regard to amending the Atomic Energy Act and the CLND, and the emphasis we have placed on nuclear energy, and I think it goes to the vision of our Prime Minister, who's very focused on this aspect of bringing in more nuclear power for a consistent, assured baseload clean energy supply in India, that you're going to see. I think this regulatory change, plus the fact that we are discussing very innovative sources of Jaitapur financing, yes, including the possibility of third country participation in some aspects and for financing, that I see that in the coming years, projects that have been, in a sense, moving very slowly for nearly a decade would certainly accelerate. So there is, I see a great future in this.
All right, Ambassador, thank you very much for being with us. I'm now joined by our correspondent, Parithi Bhanot. Parithi, thanks very much for being with us. I'm told the Prime Minister has landed just minutes back. Could you tell us about, briefly, his agenda besides the AI summit? He's also going to be meeting President Macron late tonight, India time, in Paris, right?
Good evening, Vishnu. Yes, absolutely. You got that spot on. Prime Minister Modi has been, of course, attending the AI summit, which is going to take place tomorrow, and co-chairing that. He's also going to be meeting with President Emmanuel Macron, as well as other heads of states at the Elysee Palace, which is just a stone's throw away from where I'm standing. The entire area has been cordoned off in anticipation of the arrival of the heads of states that are going to be making their way here for the state dinner. And Prime Minister Modi, of course, has just landed in Paris. And I believe in about 2 hours from now, we can expect him as well to be here at the Elysee Palace along with all the heads of state. And now, other than the AI summit, Vishnu, you asked what else is on the cards for India as well as France. One of the biggest points of strategic cooperation is defense. As you were also just talking to the former ambassador of India to France, and you rightly mentioned that nuclear is a scope of interest for both India as well as France, especially when it comes to civil nuclear agreements. The Rafale jets, of course, are another big point of cooperation between India and France. So defense is going to be on the cards, Vishnu. But other than that, there's also some good news for India. There's a consulate general of India, which is going to be inaugurated in Marseille. And that is going to happen tomorrow in the south of France. So that, of course, is going to be a big departure from just having one embassy in Paris, in the capital, to now also having a consulate general in the south of France. So that, of course, is something that we can keep our eyes peeled for.
All right, Parithi, just be with us. We've got reactions coming in from the diaspora waiting for the Prime Minister. Let's take a look.
हम तो उनकी सेहत के लिए कामना करते हैं और हम बहुत खुश हैं कि वो फिर से आ रहे हैं. मैं आगे भी प्रधानमंत्री जी को मिल चुका हूं और आज फिर ये मौका मिला है पेरिस की धरती पे, तो हम बहुत खुश हैं और सब लोग छुट्टी करके यहां पे आए हुए हैं.
छुट्टी आज का दिन भी आपने छुट्टी करी और ये बताया प्रधानमंत्री मोदी के आने से कितना इम्पैक्ट दोनों देशों के रिलेशनशिप के ऊपर आप कैसे देखते हैं, कितना बूस्ट?
दोनों देशों की रिलेशनशिप जो पहले थी समझ लो कि कुछ न थी, अब जो है वो बहुत कुछ है. और इतनी अच्छी रिलेशनशिप बनने के साथ साथ हमें जो इंडियन डायस्पोरा यहाँ पे रहते हैं उसके लिए फ्रेंच गवर्नमेंट का पूरा नजरिया बदला हुआ है. और ये सिर्फ यहाँ पे नहीं, पूरे वर्ल्ड में ये चीज आप महसूस कर पाओगे. इंडियन पासपोर्ट का वैल्यूएशन जो बड़ा है वो इनकी मेहनत की वजह से बना है.
आपका नाम? मेरा नाम पटेल बकुल है. मैं इंडियन गुजरात कल्चर एसोसिएशन का वाइस प्रेसिडेंट हूँ.
प्रधानमंत्री मोदी आने वाले हैं, जब मिलेंगे तो आपने क्या कहेंगे?
क्या कह सकते हैं मोदी जी को, हम सिर्फ धन्यवाद कह सकते हैं. आज जो इंडियन है, हम इंडियन है, इसका हम फख्र कर सकते हैं. जब से वो आए हैं तो इसने बहुत कुछ हर इंडियन के लिए दिया है. एक इमेज दी है, एक पहचान दी है, एक कहते हैं ना वैल्यू दी है. हर इंडियन आज प्राउड करता है कि हम इंडियन है. कि जब से मोदी जी आए तब से हमारी पहचान बनी है.
जी मेरा नाम शिव कुमार, मैं 40 साल से यहाँ रहता हूँ. बेसिकली मैं पंजाब से, मोहाली से, लेकिन हम मोदी से ही इतने भक्त हैं. मेरे वाइफ, मेरे बच्चे, अब मेरा पोता, आज वो आने वाला था लेकिन स्कूल से छुट्टी नहीं मिली, लेकिन कहता मेरा मोदी जी को नमस्ते बोल देना.
Parithi, let me come back to you. We've seen this with Emmanuel Macron and Prime Minister Modi, this close personal chemistry. I'm not sure at the strategic level that personal chemistry really is a decider. Everybody's got their national interests in mind, but there is that friendship, and we've seen that. Could you tell us a little bit about it?
Absolutely, Vishnu. Spot on once again. India and France, of course, have seen increased strategic cooperation over the last decade or so. You know, if I could just remind our viewers of the 2015 solar alliance that India and France started. And it's been almost 10 years since that. So that is where it all began. That's where I think it all got pushed up a notch. But as we stand here, it's really interesting because when it comes to India and France, Macron last evening spoke to the national broadcaster of France. And while he was speaking to them, he said that when it comes to India, one of the biggest things that France is looking for from India is talent. Because he said that when it comes to training, India is one of the only countries across the world that produces engineers, that produces software engineers like no other country. And so talent is really something that France needs. And that is something that it is hoping that India will be able to help it with. As for India and France, I think one of the things, and President Macron last evening rightly said so, he said that when it comes to India and France, the goal is to be a major player when it comes to AI, but at the same time also ensure Atmanirbharta, also ensure that the countries can stand on their own 2 feet in developing these technologies. So for India and France, you know, it's not just about the technologies and the exchange of technologies, but also making their countries self-reliant. And I think that is one thing that has truly stood out in this partnership between India and France. Interestingly enough, President Emmanuel Macron last evening also announced that France is going to be investing about $109 billion in the private AI sector, which he said was to compete with the United States and with the $500 billion vow that Trump has made now to private AI companies in the United States for development of AI technologies. And France, of course, wants to, wants a cake of the pie, wants to be one of the top pioneers, wants to be a pioneer when it comes to artificial intelligence technologies. And it is looking to India to help it develop these technologies. When it comes to data centers, that is something that France is looking at India for. When it comes to talent acquisition, when it comes to talent actually coming to France, cooperation between India and France in that sense, I think is something that both the nations are really looking forward to. And by the end of this 2-day summit, I believe if there's a declaration that can appease all from the private as well as the public sector, the summit will truly be a success. But Vishnu, as you know, it's really the battle, right? It's about getting the private players as well as the public players onto one single stage, onto one single platform, and saying, yes, we can go ahead with governance, we can go ahead with regulation. And that is not something that they see eye to eye on. Even as far as geopolitics is concerned, as far as the US and China are concerned, it's not clear what their stance on this is going to be and whether they're going to be on board when it comes to regulating AI. So those, of course, are some things that we're going to have to keep an eye out for. Those could be some of the potential sticking points. But as things stand between India and France, both the nations are looking to, be a part of the AI race. And, of course, they're looking to enhance their cooperation when it comes to new technologies.
All right. Thanks, Pariti, very much for being with us. We're going to keep coming back to you as we cover this very important visit of the Prime Minister to Paris. Remember, he's going to be headed to the United States after that. So that's going to be very interesting when he meets Donald Trump for the first time since Trump came to power in the United States for a second term. Remember, Trump has announced new tariffs. That does have an impact on India, perhaps not a very big one at this stage. But still, the nature of Trump's politics, how that works with India, how that strategic relationship works with the United States is certainly going to be a big focus. The Prime Minister will be arriving in the United States on the 12th night, as I understand it, meetings with Donald Trump likely on the 13th. But for the moment, it's that very important relationship with France sharply in focus. Emmanuel Macron will be meeting Prime Minister Modi in a couple of hours from now. The Prime Minister has already landed in Paris. We'll take a short break. More coming up. We'll be right back.